So last week we finished 1 Samuel 16, and we've been getting vignettes into Saul's character. Last time, when he was told to wipe out the Amalekites, he beat them in battle, but he let his army loot them, which was contrary to his instructions. And then the next thing he did is he went up to Mount Carmel, which is, by the way, halfway up Israel, and he set himself up a monument. And then from there, he went down to Gilgal, which, of course, is where Samuel met him and grabbed him by the stacking swivel and said, "How come you didn't obey God?" And he said, "Well, I did." And we have the famous line, "What then is this bleating of sheep that I hear in my ear?" So Samuel tells him that God has rejected him, and Saul asks Samuel to go with him to the sacrifice because he doesn't want to be disrespected in front of everybody, and Samuel says no. And Samuel turns to leave, and Saul grabs him by the coat, and his coat rips, and of course, Saul makes a prophecy out of that. Just like this coat is ripped, so the kingdom is going to be ripped from you. But he does go back with him. And quite frankly, Samuel very much likes Saul. Saul is tall, good-looking, brave, humble, all the things that you would normally hope for in a king. But his character isn't quite what God needs. So then we had the anointing of David as king. And as I was saying last time, 16 and 17, 17 will be David and Goliath, they seem to be out of order. Because in 16, one of the things that happens to Saul when God turns his back on him is, of course, he loses his spiritual connection. He gets what we would call today depressed. The Bible calls it an evil spirit. And his people find David and bring David into the court. David is made his armor bearer, but David's real job is to play the lyre so that whenever Saul goes into this depression, he can cheer him up. All very straightforward. When we go through David and Goliath here, one of the things that's going to happen is Saul is going to say, "Who is that kid?" That's why it seems to be out of sequence, because David is part of his court. David plays the lyre for him, and for then him to say, "Who is this?" I'm sort of the opinion that this is not put together in chronological order. Now, my dear wife came up with a different explanation, which also may be true, which is to say Saul's court has got lots of people in it. What makes anybody think that Saul is going to take any special note of a random musician? So David may play the lyre and may improve his mood and so forth, but it's sort of like listening to Muzak. Nobody knows who composed the Muzak. It's just soothing music. So that's entirely possible too. It feels to me like it's out of sequence, but we could spin a tale that made it not out of sequence if that feels good to you. So now we're down to 1 Samuel 17, and this is the incident with Goliath. I have a map up on the screen behind me. So the Philistines are camped between Azekah and Succoth, right in here. There's a valley that goes east and west here, and again, you've got a road junction, if you will. There are several ways up into the highlands from the Shephelah, and typical of encounters between Israel and the Philistines, they tend to happen in that boundary. So you have this line of hills to the east and Shephelah or flat to the west. And of course, the Philistines are chariot people. They got lots of chariots and lots of horses. So the Philistines do really well on the flat. The Israelites are infantry. So they would really rather fight in the hills where the chariots can't get up a good head of steam. One of the things to notice here is you have a trade route that goes from Succoth all the way up to Jerusalem. So one of the things that may be going on, scripture is silent, is the Philistines may be massing with the intent of going up into the central highland, because north of Jerusalem you have the Saddle of Benjamin, and you've got all sorts of routes from east to west that cross there at the Saddle of Benjamin. So this battle is obviously taking place at a key piece of terrain. And as you look at the map here, Philistines are encamped between Azekah and Sukkot. And then you have this Valley of Elah, which is between them. And then the Israelites will be on this higher country over here, probably somewhere around south of Jarmuth or east of Gadara, lay of the land. The other thing that's going to happen is David is going to get there by bringing some supplies to his brothers. And he's being sent by his dad because three of his brothers are in Saul's army. He leaves from Bethlehem, which is over here, and the distance is between 12 and 13 miles as the crow flies. So give you some idea of distances and so forth. So, 17. Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Sukkot, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Sukkot and Azekah in Ephes-Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and encamped in the Valley of Elah, drew up in battle against the Philistines. Philistines stood on the mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side with the valley between them. So the Philistines are to the south of the valley, the Israelites are to the north of the valley. There came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. For those of you who are real quick with math, a span is 9 inches or half a cubit, and of course a cubit's 18 inches, so he stands 9'9". The other thing about Goliath, we know from other pieces of scripture, he's got 4 brothers. So people wonder why David took 5 stones. I would guess on the possibility that his brothers might be in the army too. The other thing is, Goliath is obviously a giant, and we have giants before the flood, and the whole idea of the flood, according to lots of people, is to wipe out the giants. Didn't quite happen. We still have giants floating around. So Og was a giant when Moses came up the east bank of the Jordan. And of course, Goliath is a giant. And you have people with 6 fingers, which again indicates a genetic difference, if you will. So whatever it is, it didn't get wiped out. And Goliath is one of them. So I'm in verse 5. He had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. For those of you who are quick at math, that's 125 pounds. So his jacket weighs 125 pounds. Big guy, heavy coat of mail. And he had bronze armor on his legs and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and his shield bearer went before him. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, or are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves, and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistines, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. And one of the things about Israel is, as far as I know, they don't have any giants. Giants seem to be a Canaanite and a Philistine phenomenon. So this guy's standing out there every day doing some trash talk, and it's fairly obvious that neither one of them really wants to fight, because you've got these two armies drawn up with nothing but a dry stream bed between them. And if they really wanted to fight, they would. And this is an inference on my part. It's not scripture. My inference is that the reason that the Israelites are there is to close off that route that goes from the flat up to the top of the central ridge, and would allow the Philistines to take the saddle of Benjamin again. 12. Now David was the son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah, named Jesse, who had 8 sons. In the days of Saul, the man was already old and advanced in years. The 3 oldest sons of Jesse had followed Saul into battle, and the names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, and next to him, Abinadab, and third Shema. David was the youngest, and the three eldest followed Saul. But David went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep in Bethlehem. For 40 days, the Philistine came forward and took his stand morning and evening. As I say, neither one of them really wants to fight. And if the Philistines could talk them into doing single combat and their guy could win, maybe they could prevail without actually having to fight. Verse 17. Jesse said to David, his son, "Take for your brothers an ephah of this parched grain and these 10 loaves and carry them quickly to the camp of your brothers." By the way, when you think parched grain, think popcorn. Because what parched grain is grain that is not milled, but is fried a la popcorn. Wheat doesn't actually pop like popcorn, but it does open up and you can then eat it like you would eat popcorn. It's just not as bulky. And I don't know what kind of grain it is. It may have been popcorn, for all I know. Verse 18. "Also take these 10 cheeses to the commander of their thousand. See if your brothers are well and bring some token from them." So the commander of a thousand is basically about a battalion. "Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines." Well, actually they aren't fighting. "And David rose early in the morning and left the sheep with the keeper and took the provisions and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the encampment as the host was going out to the battle line, shouting the war cry." So what they're doing is they're moving forward and they're yelling and they're waving their spears and all that kind of stuff. And the other side is doing the same, and then we go home for lunch. Nobody's actually charging anybody. Have you all seen the movie Zulu? It's a wonderful movie. It's about the Battle of Rorke's Drift in South Africa. And what you had was a British infantry platoon commanded by an engineer who are cornered in a corral, which is like an adobe hacienda with an adobe wall around it and a house in the middle kind of thing. And then you have thousands of Zulus who have just wiped out another British column and they are about to wipe these guys out. And the preparatory stuff to the actual charge is very much like this. The Zulus will come out in a line and jump up and down and slam their spears against their shields and yell and all that kind of stuff. The whole idea being to intimidate, which it does. For those of you who won't watch it, spoiler alert, the platoon of British infantry holds them off for quite a while, and then the Zulus finally quit. And at the end of it, everybody's exhausted, and the Zulus form up for one more line and bang on their shields and yell, and the British say, "Oh no, are they coming again?" And the old African hand says, "No, you idiot, they're saluting your bravery and leaving." It's a great movie, it really is. If you want to see what's going on here, watch Zulu, and you'll get a really good feel for what's happening. So maybe down to verse 21. "And Israel and the Philistines drew up for battle, army against army. And David left the things in charge of the keeper of the baggage and ran to the ranks and went and greeted his brothers. As he talked with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, came out of the ranks of the Philistines and spoke the same words as before. And David heard him. All the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were much afraid. Then the men of Israel said, 'Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel.'" That last thing, make his father's house free in Israel, no income tax, no property tax, no tribute. So the idea of your father's house being free is a fairly good financial incentive, in addition to what you get to be this king's son-in-law, if that is something that interests you. 26. "And David said to the men who stood by him, 'What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?' And the people answered him in the same way, 'So it shall be done to the man who kills him.' Now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David." Oldest brother, youngest brother, and oldest brother putting youngest brother in his place. That's basically what's going on there. His anger was kindled against David, and he said, "Why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness?" In other words, you had one job, keep those few sheep, and you didn't do that. "I know your presumption and the evil of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle." In other words, you're down here to rubberneck. It's the whole gist of that, when you should be up taking care of the sheep like you're supposed to. And David said, "What have I done now? Was it not but a word?" In other words, who, me? If you've got brothers or sons, you know exactly how this exchange is going. "And he turned away from him toward another and spoke in the same way, and the people answered him again as before. When the words that David spoke were heard, they repeated them before Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, 'Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine.'" So, youngest kid in the family, supposed to be off watching sheep, and he's sort of inserted himself into the battle here. 33. "And Saul said to David, 'You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, and he has been a man of war from his youth.' But David said to Saul, 'Your servant used to keep sheep for his father, and when there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb from the flock, I went after him and struck him and delivered it out of his mouth. And if he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and struck him and killed him.'" So he's saying, "I've been in the shepherding business a while. I don't lack for courage, and I'm able to take care of sheep, bears, and Philistines." 36. "Your servant has struck down both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, for he has defied the armies of the living God." And David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go, and the Lord be with you." Now, this doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Saul's the king, commander of the army, and I'm not sure whether Saul knows David or not. Remember, we had this conversation at the beginning of the hour. It isn't clear that this is in time sequence with what happened before. So I have no idea what's going through Saul's mind. If this kid is not successful, which nobody expects him to be, then theoretically the Philistine champion has won and at least has a moral advantage over everybody. It isn't real clear to me what's going on there, at least not in Saul's mind. Now, the other thing that's going on here, though, is David has been anointed. So it's entirely possible that David is operating in the Spirit. Because remember, when he got anointed, the Spirit of God was with him and thereafter. So it's entirely possible, and in fact, I don't have any doubt, that what's going on here is at God's instigation. So that may, in fact, explain what's going on with Saul. God shut him up and said, "Do it." 38. "Then Saul clothed David with his armor. He put a helmet of bronze on his head and clothed him with a coat of mail. And David strapped his sword over his armor, and he tried in vain to go, for he had not tested them. And then David said to Saul, 'I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them.'" In other words, I am not used to wearing all this stuff. If you're wearing field gear, it's fairly important that you be trained wearing field gear so you know what you can do and what you can't do. And so just to sort of slap on all this field gear and expect then to, next 20 minutes, have your first battle is not terribly realistic. So David put them off. "Then he took his staff in his hand and chose 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in his shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand as he approached the Philistines." And as I mentioned earlier, Goliath has 4 brothers. And I think this is probably a Chuck Missler-ism I heard years and years and years ago, that he's ready for all 5. Don't know that that's the case, but it makes a nice story. "And the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. And the Philistine said to David, 'Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?' And the Philistine cursed David by his gods, The Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field." So we got more trash talk going on. And then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. And I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, and all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves not by the sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand." Then the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David. David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine in the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead and he fell on his face to the ground. Now, we've said this before, but it's worth repeating. David has the advantage in this fight. The Philistine is armed with weapons that require him to get within arm's length. David's weapon is a standoff weapon. And as probably you all know, armies of that era had units that were armed with slings. And their job was to sling stones from a distance, much like archers did later on. And archers did the same thing here too, but the sling was considered to be a serious military weapon. It's not something that, "Oh, wow, look, nobody ever thought of that. Who would have thought this kid would have hit him with a sling?" That's not the case. It was a standard piece of military equipment, and there were units that were armed with it. So for him to be standing off at some distance where the Philistine can't grapple with him, as long as he doesn't miss with his stone, he has the tactical advantage. In the Philistine's eyes, this is not a fair fight, because the Philistine wants to stand toe-to-toe and swing at each other with swords and spears and all that kind of stuff. David isn't playing that game because that's the Philistine's game. I have also read, and I don't know if this is true, historical medical people have opined that the Philistine had a growth defect and may well have been not able to see very far, because apparently, at least in modern humanity, giantism often comes with other impairments. You can't see as well, or you can't hear as well, or those kinds of things. That I have no idea. It's just something I read, and do with that as seems good to you. But the fact is, David has absolutely no intention of getting within grappling distance of this guy. Hence his choice of weapon, hence his not taking armor and swords and so forth. 50. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling with a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. There was no sword in the hand of David. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. Then the Philistines saw their champion was dead. They fled. And the men of Israel and Judah rose with a shout and pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron, which is to the west of where the battle was. So that the wounded Philistines fell on the way from Sha'arim as far as Gath and Ekron. And the people of Israel came back from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their camp. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it up to Jerusalem. He put his armor in his tent. Now, this seems strange, because the last we heard of Saul, Saul was with the army in a camp. So if you're going to be trucking this guy's head around and showing it to Saul and say, "Look, I did it," why are we going to Jerusalem? That isn't to say I doubt any of the events. It's simply the sequencing is a bit odd. And when it says he put his armor in his tent, I am assuming that is Goliath's armor. Because remember, Goliath has got a coat of mail that's 125 pounds of bronze. That's big money. Okay? That much refined metal is expensive. Even if the coat of mail won't fit you, it can be broken up and sold. And we'll find out later in the book that the sword of Goliath winds up at Nob, which is where the priests are. So when David is fleeing from Saul later on, and he goes to Nob, and that's where he eats the showbread. Then he says, "You guys got a sword?" "We don't have a sword." "Well, actually, we do. We got the one that you took off of Goliath, which was not intended to be a weapon used. It was a trophy. But David took it." So 55. "As soon as Saul saw David go out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of his army, 'Abner, whose son is this youth?' And Abner said, 'As your soul lives, O king, I do not know.'" All right. So again, this tells me that things are out of sequence, because Abner is the commander of the army. And if the title that David had been given back in chapter 16 was Saul's armor bearer, even if Saul didn't know the kid's name, I would expect Abner would have. The way this is written feels like this is sort of David's debut. If you remember earlier in chapter 16, when Saul is depressed and spirit oppressed, and they say, "Let's get somebody to play some music for him." What they said is, the son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, his son David is good looking, wise, and a mighty man of valor. Well, after this, the mighty man of valor tag is exactly appropriate. Back in 16, we had not heard anything about David other than the fact that God picked him. So chapter 17 feels like it's got a bunch of stuff out of sequence. Not that I doubt that all the things happen, it's just the sequencing is weird. And Abner said, "As your soul lives, king, I do not know." And the king said, "Inquire whose son the boy is." And as soon as David returned from the striking down of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. Now, the last we saw of Goliath's head, after it was detached from the rest of Goliath, was headed to Jerusalem. And here we've got what is apparently Saul's field command post, which is where Abner would be, and Saul would see the battle progressing, etc. And it makes great sense to have Goliath's head brought there. And, you know, later on, I'm sure it did get to Jerusalem, but as I say, the sequencing here is just strange. So 57 again. "As soon as David returned from striking down the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, 'Whose son are you, young man?' And David answered, 'I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite.'" Chapter 18. "As soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David, and his armor, and even his sword and his bow and his belt. And David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him, so that Saul set him over the men of war, and this was good in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants." Several things going on here. This bond between David and Jonathan. Later on in English literature and so forth, that will be used as a euphemism for homosexuality. I do not believe for a minute that that's what's going on here, because both David and Jonathan have wives and children and all that. And in fact, the thing that makes David stumble is seeing Bathsheba on the roof next door taking a bath. I do not get the impression that David swings both ways, but later on, whenever somebody wants to make a snide comment about two homosexuals, they'll say something about David and Jonathan. Just again, so you know that. We get a look at David here in verse 5. "David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him, so that Saul set him over the men of war. And this was good in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servant." Remember, we talked about Saul and his qualifications. When God anointed Saul king, he's tall. He is a Hollywood central casting guy that you would pick for the hero of your movie. Tall, good looking, athletic, brave, humble, sort of reminds you of Gregory Peck. And it's only as Saul's character is developed that we find out why Saul is not a suitable king. David has all the same qualifications. He's good looking, he's athletic, he's brave, and as we saw back in chapter 16, he is regarded as wise. In other words, the words out of his mouth are regarded as timely and wise. So he's one of these charismatic people that people like. So when he gets put in charge of a military unit and he is successful, partially because God is with him, partially because he's good. So people like him and they look up to him and so forth. And this is, of course, going to be a problem because he is going to eclipse Saul. Obviously, that's not going to sit well with Saul. Verse 6. As they were coming home, when David returned from striking down the Philistine, the women came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul, with tambourines, with songs of joy, and with musical instruments. And the women sang to one another as they celebrated. Saul has struck down his thousands, and David his 10,000s. And Saul was very angry. And this saying displeased him. He said, they have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed thousands. What more can he have but the kingdom? And Saul eyed David from that day on. This has all been building up. It started back at Gilgal when Saul was trying to get a read on the situation from God, and he was hearing nothing. Then we have the incident where he made the rash vow, nobody's supposed to eat. Then, of course, we have things taken away from him. And the point is, the king of Israel needs a spiritual connection to God. Saul has lost it. Saul knows he's lost it. So the fact that he's lost it destroys his confidence, if you will. Later on, when David has been a king for a while, they go out to battle and David goes out with them. The army looks at him and says, words to this effect, you've lost a step, you're getting old. You don't go out with us anymore because we can't afford to lose you. So when a king goes out with his army, it is not expected that that king is going to be in the middle of the battle leading a battalion. That's David's job. So the fact that David is successful in slaughtering people and so forth is what he's supposed to do. But Saul, having lost his connection to God and having been told by Samuel that the kingdom was going to be taken away from him, is basically paranoid. And any indication that he's not the top dog goes right to his spirit. And by the time he dies, he's actually quite mad. And it's all paranoia. Verse 10. The next day, a harmful spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved within the house while David was playing the lyre, as he did day by day. Saul had his spear in his hand, and Saul hurled his spear, for he thought, I will pin David to the wall. But David evaded him twice. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. So Saul removed him from his presence and made him commander of 1,000. And he went out and came in before the people. So what he's done is he made him a battalion commander. Commander of 1,000 is about a battalion, maybe a light brigade. The idea here is I'm going to keep this guy in the field, and I am going to hope that the Philistines take care of him for me. What's happening here is Saul is being driven into paranoia and madness, and David is gradually succeeding. And what's going to happen is when finally Saul falls, David will have a resume that allows him first to become king in Hebron and then gradually to unite all the tribes. So God's done with Saul. It's going to take a while for the body to fall, but God's done with Saul. So we're all the way down to 17. Now this is unique in all of Scripture. Then Saul said to David, here is my elder daughter Merab. I will give her to you for a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles. For Saul thought, let not my hand be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him. In other words, I'm just going to keep sending him into danger until the Philistines get rid of this little jerk. And David said to Saul, who am I and who are my relatives my father's clan in Israel, I should be the son-in-law to the king. But at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, she was given to Adriel, the Meholathite, for a wife. Now Saul's daughter Michal loved David, and they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. This is the only instance in at least the Old Testament where a woman loves a man. Marriages were arranged, and the pattern was you got married and then you learned to love each other. And there is nothing in at least the Old Testament where a woman spontaneously loves a man. This isn't there. So that's kind of interesting. And it tells you also something about David. I don't know what Michael's attraction to David is, but, you know, I mean, he's charismatic, he's good-looking and brave and all that kind of stuff. So the fact that a woman should desire him is not strange, but this is the only place that shows up in Scripture. 21, Saul thought, let me give her to him, that she may be a snare for him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. So Saul is thinking that his daughter will be loyal to him and will give him information on David. Therefore, Saul said to David a second time, you shall now be my son-in-law. And Saul commanded his servants, speak to David in private and say, behold, the king has delight in you, and all his servants love you. Now then, become the king's son-in-law. And Saul's servants spoke these words in the ears of David. And David says, does it seem to you a little thing to become the king's son-in-law since I'm poor and have no reputation? Well, he does have a reputation, but anyway. And the servants of Saul told him, thus and so did David speak. Then Saul said, thus you shall say to David. This is all obviously going on by intermediaries. Then Saul said, this you shall say to David, the king desires no bride price except 100 foreskins of the Philistines, that he may be avenged of the king's enemies. Now Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. In other words, collecting Philistine foreskins is not a thing without some risk. And David said, wow, is that all you want? Just 100? Piece of cake. 26. And when his servants told David these words, it pleased David well to be the king's son-in-law. Before the time had expired, David arose and went along with his men and killed 200 of the Philistines. And David brought their foreskins, which were given in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. And Saul gave him his daughter Michal for a wife. But when Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, Saul was even more afraid of David. So Saul was David's enemy continually. So again, Saul is trying to set David up to fail. So the first thing is, well, I'll just give him my daughter and she'll be my spy in David's house. And he sees now, no, that isn't going to work because she loves him. And of course, the other one is, well, I'll send him off on a suicide mission. And that didn't work either. So, verse 30. Then the princes of the Philistines came out to battle, and as often as they came out, David had more success than all the servants of Saul, so that his name was highly esteemed. So, God is with David, and David has natural talents for God to work with. Saul is gradually seeing that this is going to be his replacement. And so the next thing we'll do is the business where Saul tries to take David out.